This week I spoke with Doug Klein, a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, where he focuses on Russia's war on Ukraine. He's the former assistant director of the Eurasia Center and currently a policy analyst at the nonprofit Razum for Ukraine. The conversation covers the recent German military leak and what was actually said, the kinds of weapons Ukraine needs, the general state of the war, the impact of U.S. politics, Ukrainian grain exports, a potential Trump presidency, whether Putin will stop at Ukraine if he wins the war, Russia's genocidal actions in Ukraine, the evisceration of Russian media, the impact of sanctions, Zelensky's recent change in generals, Russia and Ukraine's respective methods of waging war, why it matters for Americans to support Ukraine, and much more. I hope you'll enjoy. So the first thing I'd like to ask you about is the recent situation with regard to the Germans conspiring to blow up a bridge, or at least that's the way that it was reported and gossiped about in some outlets. But maybe you can help provide some clarification on exactly what happened there.
Yeah, so I think that this story, unfortunately, is being widely misinterpreted. And that is in part because the Kremlin is intentionally trying to create a narrative around this, intentionally trying to create a narrative that the Germans are conspiring to blow up the Kerch Strait Bridge. And that's not what's happening. I went through and I read the transcript of this call between German military leaders that was intercepted and leaked by Russian intelligence and published by RT and Margarita Semenyan, the Kremlin's chief propagandist. And what this conversation was about was German military leaders who are preparing for a briefing that they are going to give Boris Pistorius, the German defense minister. Pistorius is going to be laying out the options about the provision of Taurus cruise missiles, which would be an important asset for Ukraine, just as Storm Shadows and Scalp EG missiles from the UK and France are. They've given Ukraine important new capabilities. Taurus missiles would do that too. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has been incredibly resistant to providing Taurus missiles. He's given a lot of reasons. Some have been fair reasons. Many have been quite unfair reasons.
Can you lay those reasons out very briefly?
Sure. So Scholz, the big thing that he has said, especially in recent weeks, is that if Germany were to provide Taurus missiles to Ukraine, that could make Germany a party to the conflict. That perhaps there would, it would require German military personnel being on the ground in Ukraine to help the Ukrainians use these missiles. That's a specific reason that Scholz gave for why he would not provide Taurus missiles. In this call, these military officials were talking about what are the logistics of if Germany were hypothetically to provide these missiles, what would it look like for training Ukrainian forces? How would the missiles be transported to Ukraine? Would Germany need to help provide targeting data? Would it require German personnel on the ground to help operate it? And on that specific point, they said we probably would not require German personnel to be on the ground. Where the Kerch Strait Bridge came up in this conversation was, these officials are again talking through if Germany were to provide Taurus missiles, what would happen next? And they're recognizing that for Ukraine, there are two key priorities, two key targets that the Ukrainians would like to hit. One is ammunition depots behind Russian lines. The Russians have a serious ammunition advantage right now. And one way to even that out is by taking out Russian ammunition depots. Another high priority target for the Ukrainians is the Kerch Strait Bridge. It goes from Crimea to another Ukrainian island, Tuzla Island, and then from there to Russia. So the part of the bridge that has been struck before and that could be struck again is this part that is wholly on Ukrainian territory between Crimea and Tuzla Island. And it's a vital strategic logistics link from Russia to Crimea. There's two ways that Crimea is supplied, that the occupation continues. One is across this bridge. Another is across the quote-unquote land bridge, the land that has been taken and occupied on the north side of the Azov Sea. And so if this bridge was destroyed, Russia's occupation of Crimea would become much more difficult. And so these German officials were talking about that, saying, look, if we provide Taurus missiles, it is quite likely that the Ukrainians will go after that bridge. And so what would that mean? So there are many people that have unfortunately parroted the Kremlin's framing of this conversation, saying the Germans are plotting to destroy the Kerch Bridge themselves, and that is not what they were talking about.
So they were essentially, just to summarize what you said, they were just walking through some scenarios. Specifically, they quite reasonably are thinking the Ukrainians are probably going to want to take out this bridge. It makes sense that they would want to take out this bridge. We don't really want to give them Taurus missiles that they could then use to take out the bridge, because then we're getting it involved to a level that we don't want to. How likely is it that they will do that? And what are we going to do if they do that? As opposed to the way that it has been reported by some, we'd like to give them these missiles because we're going to help them take out this bridge.
I think you're spot on there. I mean, this is what military officials do. They are quite good at thinking out scenarios and thinking out, you know, what could happen? What are the range of possibilities? So they can provide this menu of options to the political leadership. You know, they're not coming up with some secret strike plan that the Germans are going to carry out.
It's quite a distortion. What would be some of the other distortions you think that the Kremlin has been successful in perpetuating in this war? And I think one, obviously, that comes to mind is the whole thing with the Nazis and Ukrainians being Nazis and denazification. Do any other spring to your mind as being just quite obvious misconceptions that nevertheless managed to spread?
Yeah, there's a couple things that come to mind. You know, obviously the Nazi example that you gave is one that has been around since 2014, especially. The Russians have used this myth, this, you know, distortion to try to frame Ukraine as a Nazi state, to delegitimize this people's uprising, the Revolution of Dignity, a grassroots revolution against Ukraine's then strongman, Viktor Yanukovych. And they've tried to delegitimize modern Ukraine by calling it a Nazi state. Putin repeats this all the time. Another thing that the Russians, I think, try to fuel is a perception that Ukraine can't be trusted with Western aid, that it is so corrupt that everything gets stolen and there's no oversight and accountability. Ukraine is certainly, from the U.S. perspective, Ukraine is doing quite well on oversight and accountability of the aid that has been provided. And I think that that's something that there should be far more education on. The Ukrainians have complied with every condition that the United States has put in place for oversight of U.S. aid. You know, one specific thing that they do is they've been provided with NATO standard scanners, this logistics equipment and software, where every physical piece of aid that comes into Ukraine, it's scanned. Well, you know, a little barcode on it gets scanned and uploaded into this system. And then in real time, as it travels through Ukraine, its location is visible to U.S. officials back in Washington. They can monitor where stuff is. And the U.S. Embassy in Kyiv is overseeing the largest foreign aid package in recent memory, I think probably since World War II. And so it's quite an impressive amount of oversight that is being done. But of course, it's very easy to just say, well, Ukraine is hopelessly corrupt and they can't be trusted.
Can you walk us through some of the other weapon systems that the Ukrainians say that they need, or that we understand that they want, but that they, you know, there's been this conversation going on for a while now that they're not getting what they need, or they are getting it, but it's too little too late. At this point in the war, what does it seem that they would like to have that they're not getting, and why aren't they getting it? What are the reasons for that?
Yeah. So I'll start with two flashy things and then one very unsexy but important thing. The two flashy things that I'll say are, one, cruise missiles, specifically these Taurus missiles from Germany that we're talking about, as well as ATACMS missiles from the United States, Army tactical cruise missiles. This is something that has been provided in a small, limited number to Ukraine previously, after over a year of pressure on the White House to give these cruise missiles to Ukraine. They gave them just about 19, I believe, late last year. And Ukraine used those missiles to take out about 20% of Russia's Ka-52 attack helicopter fleet in one night. It was a very impressive and important strike that they carried out thanks to the ATACMS missiles. Now, the ATACMS missiles that the U.S. provided Ukraine with, they were an older, shorter range cluster munition variant. And what that means is there's a couple different variants of this missile. And what we gave them was something that had shorter range, it couldn't fire as far. And the kind of payload that it carried was cluster munitions. It fires off, you know, hundreds of little explosive bomblets that spread out. Now, The thing that we should really provide them that would make quite a difference is a longer range unitary warhead version of ATACMS. And that's a missile that can travel farther. And instead of all those little bomblets, it has one very big bomb in it. And that's something that could be used similarly to how the Storm Shadow missiles have been used. It would be able to go farther and go after different kinds of targets. And so that would be something that would also be quite useful to Ukraine. Now, those are that's one of these kind of flashier things I mentioned. Another one is, of course, air power, F-16s. Ukrainian pilots are getting close to finishing up with this training program that they're going through to get F-16s. And we're hoping that later this year, Ukraine can start to receive some of these fighter jets. That's something that the Ukrainians have been asking for since day one of the full-scale invasion. And it's going to do a couple of important things. One, it's going to help with Ukraine's air defense. As Russian bombers are taking off to try to go after Ukrainian cities, the Ukrainians will have better capabilities to try to shoot them down before they're able to launch their missiles at Ukrainian civilians. Another thing that it's going to do is it's going to make other types of aid that the U.S. has provided to Ukraine more effective. We have given them other kinds of, air-to-ground missiles, things that are fired from a fighter jet and can strike a Russian ammunition depot, for example. And these are Western NATO-type missiles that have been kind of jerry-rigged to work on Ukraine's existing Soviet-era fighter jets. Now, it works, but if you pair them with, say, an F-16 and the kinds of sensors and optics and the systems that are in an F-16, it means that these missiles that we've provided Ukraine can be more accurate, can go farther. It takes what we've given Ukraine and it multiplies its effectiveness. So there's going to be, I think, some notable advantages that come when Ukraine starts to get F-16s. So air power and cruise missiles, those are two flashy things that Ukraine wants. The other really important thing is artillery shells. Lots and lots and lots of artillery shells. There are not enough out there, and Ukraine needs more. The West has grossly misunderstood the burn rate, or the rate of consumption that modern warfare, total warfare, requires. Ukraine is going through tens of thousands of artillery shells a day, or it was at the height of when it had good supplies. In recent months, ammunition and aid from the West, particularly from the United States, which has all but stopped. Because this aid is stopping, Ukraine is running very low on ammunition. They are having to ration these artillery shells on the front line. Some reports that you see an artillery battery, they only fire 3 or 4 shells a day. The Russians have about a 6.5-to-1 advantage, firing 6.5 shells for every one that the Ukrainians can fire. And that is a very bad disadvantage for Ukraine. Last year, because of Western aid, they had helped to close that gap. They were getting kind of close to parity with the rate of fire that the Russians were doing. But now, because we've stopped giving them aid, the Russians are getting the advantage again. We're seeing that impact on the battlefield. So a big hope for me is that the United States Congress is able to pass supplemental aid for Ukraine soon, and that we can start getting quite a lot of artillery shells over there. There's another important plan that I'll mention that came from Czechia. They had this idea of, look, we've identified about 800,000 artillery shells that are on the global market. The European countries should band together, purchase these 800,000 artillery shells and give them to Ukraine immediately. There were some disputes. The French said, we don't want to use EU funds to buy weapons that aren't made in Europe. But the French thankfully have dropped that objection. And it looks like this plan will succeed soon, and that Ukraine will get a really important injection of artillery shells.
Did I miss the unsexy option? Was that the artillery shells?
Yeah, the artillery shells are the unsexy option. You can talk about flashy, very modern, top of the line military systems, but artillery shells are an old thing, and they're really, really important, and we need to be producing a lot of them.
And the reluctance to give them, let's say, these longer range missiles, is it simply because of a concern that Ukraine will use them to fire into Russia and the war will escalate and Putin might hit the nuclear button. Is that the primary concern there, or is it something else?
These escalation fears have been really pervasive, particularly in Washington and Berlin. But I think that they have been, in my opinion, disproven quite a couple of times. Now, in terms of this fear that perhaps the Ukrainians could get these missiles and use them to strike the Kremlin and blow up Vladimir Putin in his sleep, well, the Ukrainians have listened to the concerns that Western partners have. You know, we have set boundaries on how we want them to use the aid that we have provided. And one of these things has been, you know, don't use Western weapons to strike inside Russian territory. And the Ukrainians respected that. They have been striking inside Russian territory, but they've been doing it with drones, things that they have made themselves, and not, you know, they're respecting the acts. Mm-hmm. So I think that they have given us no reason to believe that if we were to give them these missiles and told them, you know, don't use them inside Russia, they've given us no reason to believe that we can trust them on that way. And I think that in Kyiv, they understand, you know, if we make a promise on something and then violate that promise, then we're going to jeopardize future aid.
This is all very technical a bit and in the weeds, which is wonderful. But let's just zoom all the way out and give us your assessment of just the war as it stands now in general. It seems as if both sides are kind of grinding it out at this point. There's been a lot of talk about whether or not Russia sort of had the plan all along to get to a stage where it will just grind through and eventually be able to, by the sheer weight of its size, win that way. And we see that in some ways, I think Zelensky is very sensitive to the public perception of his capacity to win because of a belief, I think, that he thinks that he'll be able to garner more support if he's seen as a winner. Do you think that we're looking at a stalemate? Uh-oh. Do you think that just, you know, if you could just sum that up for us, like where, you know, to 10,000 foot view, what does the war look like right now?
Yeah. So I think that the story of 2024 is quite likely to be Ukraine needs to dig in, survive these coming Russian offensives. President Zelensky has said that Russia is planning a new offensive late spring, perhaps early summer. Dig in, survive these offensives, and then hopefully get new Western aid, resupply, rearm, reconstitute Ukraine's armed forces, and hopefully prepare for some kind of a new offensive, perhaps in 2025. Set the conditions on the battlefield for future success. You know, they've learned some really important lessons, I think, from the 2023 counteroffensive and the delay in Western aid leading up to that offensive last year really had a significant impact on the battlefield. Some of these impacts are a bit unreversible. One of the big things was that because the West delayed aid to Ukraine, Russia had time to dig in, to fortify the occupied territories, to create the so-called Surovikin line, this three-tiered layer of defense, you know, that Ukraine really struggled to break through. And they had time to prepare like that. And so giving Ukraine aid in a timely manner is really an important part of preparing them and setting them up for success. And we didn't do it before. So this year, something that I think Putin has been banking on is that Western support for Ukraine is not sustainable, that we will get tired, that our political divisions will make it untenable domestically. And we're seeing that in the United States right now. We're seeing domestic divisions, domestic politics, and you know the fact that Congress is institutionally quite broken. That is having a very real impact on the battlefield.
Do you think that perhaps Putin is simply, he's grinding it out and maybe just waiting for the U.S. presidential election to see what happens there?
Yeah, I think he is. In Putin's mind, you know, when Donald Trump was president last time, he had somebody who was you know, a U.S. president that was quite affectionate to Vladimir Putin. You know, I remember in Helsinki, as I think a lot of people do, when Donald Trump said that he trusted Vladimir Putin more than the U.S.'s own intelligence agencies. That was a stunning thing to say. Now, during the Trump administration, we can get into a bigger discussion if you want about, you know, will Trump be good or bad for Ukraine? I believe that there's a lot of reasons to expect that it would be quite bad for Ukraine. And so for Putin right now, he's, I think, grinding it out and trying to wait and see what are these things that in the U.S. in particular can jeopardize U.S. support for Ukraine, can keep the U.S. from giving Ukraine the tools that it needs? Can Congress be so dysfunctional that it can't pass new aid to Ukraine? Could a new U.S. president come in who wants to dial back support, who says, you know, I can end the war in 24 hours, who perhaps undermines NATO as well as he's said he would do? These are things that give Putin cause for optimism.
Does that conversely mean that Zelensky has the pressure of time and maybe needs to get some things accomplished before the election?
I think that in Ukraine and in Zelensky's mind right now, things really hinge on passing this supplemental aid in Congress. And there are a lot of reasons for optimism. I'm personally optimistic, and I think that that aid is going to get passed. But of course, the delay in getting that aid passed is having real negative impacts. You know, we're going on month 7 of debating supplemental aid. There's not a lot of opportunities, I think, on the battlefield for Ukrainian forces to make major successes and break through Russian lines. And so they're taking these wins where they can. The Black Sea is a place where they can get really significant wins. You know, just I think yesterday or the day before, they took out another Russian ship. And at this point, I believe Ukrainian forces have destroyed about a third of the Black Sea fleet. And, you know, for a country with really no navy to destroy that much of the Black Sea fleet, including the flagship, the Moskva, that's a really notable success. After Russia closed the Black Sea grain corridor to try to unilaterally pressure Ukraine and pressure much of the rest of the world that is dependent on Ukrainian foodstuffs, Ukraine unilaterally reopened. And the capacity of how much grain they're getting to market now is quite impressive. And that's an economic lifeline. That was, you know, while the counteroffensive last year was largely unsuccessful, the big success in the Black Sea and this victory in the Battle of the Black Sea as to now is quite important for you.
So let's go back to your earlier comment about potential outcome of if Trump wins, what do you foresee happening there?
Yeah, there's a debate in Washington right now about whether Trump would be good for Ukraine or bad for Ukraine. What are his impulses? What would he do? And among a lot of Republicans, there is this framing of it as during the first Trump administration, we had some of the strongest measures against Russia that we have seen in quite some time. Stronger than what Barack Obama did, stronger than what Joe Biden has done. And, you know, the things that they point to in particular are sanctions against Russia, sanctions against the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, and the provision, finally, of Javelin missiles to Ukraine, something that Obama had refused to do, but that Trump finally got done. He got Ukraine lethal aid, and we've seen just how important those javelins in particular were for the opening months of Russia's full-scale invasion. I don't really buy this narrative, though, and my reasoning for it is those were real achievements under the Trump administration, and the Trump administration deserves credit for that. But those were achievements that came not because Donald Trump himself decided, I'm going to take a stand against Russia. I'm going to stand and support the brave Ukrainian people. Those accomplishments happened because of real foreign policy experts in the Trump administration, people who were knowledgeable, credible Republican national security experts who understood these good policies and pushed them and got them done. And we have every reason to believe that in a second Trump administration, those experts are not coming back. Those are the people that now have talked about Trump is, you know, his former Secretary of Defense, for example, has said that Trump is a threat to national security. Former Trump officials that pushed these kinds of policies, they've talked about just how disastrous things were in the Trump administration. And we know, you know, about this Project 2025 that is being prepared by the Heritage Foundation in particular to staff out a Trump administration with tens of thousands of political loyalists. This new administration would, I think, fuel Trump's worst instincts, especially when it comes to foreign policy. You know, we'll see prominent foreign policy voices like Rick Grenell, who is the former U.S. ambassador to Germany. You know, he's somebody whose name has been floated as a potential Trump Secretary of State. And he's somebody who is perhaps the opposite of a transatlanticist. He is somebody who does not believe in the importance of U.S. Europe ties. Trump launched a trade war against Europe last time. You know, these are things that I think say Trump's worst instincts towards Ukraine and Russia and Vladimir Putin would be fueled, not curbed.
Okay, let's say that Trump does win and the United States goes isolationist. Is there a path forward for Ukraine depending more heavily on European aid? What does that look like? How heavily is their victory reliant upon the full backing of the United States?
So the starting point on this is, as of now, there is no good alternative to U.S. military support for Ukraine. Europe is ramping up its defense production. They are realizing that they cannot fill this gap for Ukraine if the United States steps out. And that's a reality. You know, Europe is trying to ramp up its production, but that's going to take time. It's going to take years to reverse decades of underinvestment in the European defense production base. So there is no quick fix here should the United States dial back its support or walk away completely. And that presents a real and meaningful risk for Ukraine. Europe is taking steps, as I said, to try to address this problem. In European capitals right now, policymakers are really quite alarmed at this risk. And they're coming to terms, I think, with the possibility that Trump could win again and that he could choose to step back. You know, we're recording right now, and I think just yesterday, on March 6th, EU had released its new defense industrial strategy. And it's the first time that the EU as a bloc has put out a formal strategy saying, we have historically underinvested in our defense industrial base. There's a reason why when we're trying to give another 800,000 artillery shells to Ukraine, we don't have them ourselves. We can't produce them ourselves, right? And so they are trying to invest in their industrial base to build this capacity to meet these needs in the future. And that's great, but that's not going to solve the problem in the short term. That is a medium to long term solution.
Speaking of a Trump presidency and underinvestment in military spending by European powers, one thing that Trump often harps on is underpayment into NATO by European countries. If they were paying the 2%, right? If they were paying what they should be paying, what they've agreed to pay, do you think that most, if not all, of this problem, I mean, it's not something that's going to be corrected in short order, as you say, and time is of the essence here, but let's imagine a world in which they had been paying up until now. Do you think we would still be facing the same problem, or is it a much larger issue than that?
I think that, you know, in this hypothetical, let's say 20 years ago, you know, all members of NATO were spending 2% of their GDP on defense. I don't think that that would have solved this problem that we're facing right now. Because let's remember, the U.S. certainly has been paying more than 2% of its GDP on defense. And the U.S. is not able to meet the needs of Ukraine right now. What this is about is decades of underinvestment in our defense industrial bases, factories that produced artillery shells and howitzer barrels and what, and, you know, and ammunition, what have you. You know, these factories shut down. And this is about what happened after the Cold War. During the Cold War, we had these broad industrial bases to meet the potential needs of a total war between superpowers. After the Cold War, we saw the peace dividend. This money that we were spending on defense, it can be spent on other things now. Social programs, a welfare state, on all these other things that you know are important for thriving societies beyond just defense. But we saw that shift in spending that way. The war on terror, the global war on terror, also had a contributing impact on this. You know, the U.S. in particular shifted the things that it was producing away from lots of artillery shells, again, for example, to things that could be used for counterterror operations, more precision weapons, you know, more expensive weapons, things that are geared for fighting, you know, an insurgency or a terrorist group rather than the Russian Federation. So even if we had, you know, Europe had met this kind of spending goal for the last two decades, let's say, there are still lots of other factors that I think would keep us in this situation right now.
Okay, that's the past hypothetical. Here's a future hypothetical. Russia wins. Do they stop there, do you think, based on Putin's past statements and behavior up until this point? Or do you have serious concerns that he continues to push?
I have serious concerns that he continues to push. Putin and other Russian officials, they don't try to hide what their ambitions are. They don't try to hide what they want to do. They were very clear about what they wanted to do in Ukraine. They wanted to overthrow the democratically elected government in Ukraine. They had lists of thousands of civil society leaders, journalists, government officials, people who could rally resistance to Ukrainian occupation. They were going to round these people up and put them into camps to keep them from resisting Russian occupation. They are deporting tens of thousands of Ukrainian children and having them adopted into Russian families. They're trying to erase a new generation of Ukrainians. They are very clear about their intention to eradicate Ukraine as a concept. And they're very clear that after Ukraine, they want to reconstitute their forces and keep going. Putin sees more states in Europe as the rightful property of Russia, just as Ukraine is. That's why the Baltic states are so alarmed. That's why Sweden and Finland gave up long-standing neutrality to join NATO because of this invasion. They feared that if Ukraine falls, they would be next. And just about a half hour before we started this interview, Sweden formally joined NATO. The papers were delivered to the White House, and it is official. NATO has enlarged to include Sweden. And that happened because more European states fear that they are next.
It seems as if some of this has sort of backfired in Putin's face in that sense. Given the way that you describe him having taken children and targeting Ukrainian culture and statements to the effect that Ukraine is not a real country, and not to mention the massacres that have taken place, do you think that it's fair to characterize Putin's project here as one of as a genocidal project to eradicate the people of Ukraine and their culture and essentially to make it so that there is no such thing as Ukrainians and that they are all Russians?
I think it's fair to call what Russia is doing in Ukraine genocide. This is a genocidal war, and Russia is carrying out premeditated programs aimed at erasing Ukrainian identity, Ukrainian culture, Ukrainian language. There are, you know, when people talk about this invasion being one of Russia trying to meet its security needs, fearing NATO expansion, fearing, you know, Ukraine as a potential security risk for Russia, this is just about Russia's security. I can't help but ask, then why is Russia doing everything it does in these occupied territories? Why does it replace road signs that are written in Ukrainian with ones written in Russian? Why does it encourage Ukrainian people to surrender their Ukrainian passports, get Russian ones, and change their names to sound more Russian? Why is it taking tens of thousands of Ukrainian children and bringing them into a network of camps in Russia where they have changed adoption laws to adopt them into Russian families and raise them as Russians to forget who they are? That's one of the most insidious things in my mind. And it's premeditated too. There has been plenty of reporting about how before the February 24th, 2022 invasion, the Russian government created incentive formulas to pay out money to Russian regions based on how many Ukrainians they brought into those Russian regions, formulas that will incentivize them to house more captured Ukrainians far across Russia. That has nothing to do with Russian security. It has everything to do with trying to break a people and wipe them out.
What you say about the adoption, I mean, that reminds me of the stories of forcibly adopting Native American and Aboriginal children in order to, quote unquote, civilize them, which I'm sure Russia's probably framing it the same way. They're helping and civilizing these children. It has the same sort of flavor to it.
100%. And that's the reason why, you know, there are arrest warrants out from the you know, from The Hague for Vladimir Putin and for his children's rights commissioner, Maria Lvova-Belova, for abducting these children. You know, those are the arrest warrants that are out for them. And it's for this issue, because it's one of the clearest examples of, under international law, commission of genocide.
What is the sentiment like in Russia right now? How supportive is the public? And how many Russians are there who would be listening to this or seeing reports of these children, for instance, or any of the rest of it? And, you know, I know that there are people who are opposed to Putin, but is there anything like enough of a groundswell to actually have an impact, or do you think Putin is just too firmly entrenched and that's just a pipe dream?
I'm not optimistic about some groundswell of Russian opposition inside Russia to overthrow Putin and stop the war. I'm not optimistic about that happening. And there are plenty of reasons why that's the reality. You know, one is a general apathy in Russia towards the war. Most people aren't particularly in favor, but aren't particularly opposed. And if they are opposed, it's really more because, you know, the war has negatively impacted Russia rather than because it's, you know, a grave breach of international law and a crime against humanity. You know, if they oppose it, it's more likely than not because their son has been sent off to fight and been killed, you know, not because of what that son may have done to innocent Ukrainians. And so that general public apathy towards the war is one reason for this. But another reason that I think is important to remember is that before Putin launched his invasion, he eviscerated Russian civil society and political opposition. Before the invasion, he tried to assassinate Alexei Navalny and then imprisoned him in a series of penal colonies. He shut down Navalny's national network, you know, his anti-corruption foundation and his smart voting program that tried to rally people in Russia to vote strategically to defeat Putin candidates. You know, that network was taken apart and either jailed or forced underground or forced out of the country. Russia's free media has been eviscerated as well. They've been either forced out of the country or forced to liquidate. Russia's oldest NGO, Memorial, which was founded to remember and commemorate and acknowledge the horrific crimes of the Stalin era under, you know, during the Soviet Union, to remember these crimes that had been committed and to never commit them again. And that NGO was forcibly liquidated as well. So all of these centers in Russian society where, let's say hypothetically, the full-scale invasion launched and people wanted to resist, wanted to protest, wanted to try to stop it, who would rally them? Who would they organize around? These centers where they could have organized were effectively destroyed before the invasion even began. And then certainly at a much higher rate after the invasion, that's when a lot of the media repressions really accelerated.
Are the sanctions not having a significant impact? Sometimes I see videos that people are posting on social media of streets in Moscow with the commentary being that it looks as if life is unaltered. And, you know, is it not the case that sanctions have had a deep impact and this is not having any effect on Russian sentiment? Or is it really just life as usual in Russia?
Sanctions have been an important tool, but they're not a silver bullet, and they don't happen quickly. It takes a long time for sanctions to have a noticeable and meaningful impact. We're 2 years into this full-scale invasion, about 2 years into this new sanctions regime, and we're starting to see some impacts, but it's not some society-altering thing, at least not yet. There are also quite a lot of loopholes in the Western sanctions regime. There are ways that sanctioned goods still make their way into Russia. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I moderated a briefing that you know, we hosted in Congress for congressional staff on how Western tech is still making its way into Russian weapons. And, you know, there's a great report from the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, about how Texas Instruments, which I think most Americans will recognize for the TI-84 calculator, chips made by Texas Instruments are still being found in Russian Iskander cruise missiles. Chips and components that have been made, that were manufactured after February 2022, are still being found over there. A lot of gaps. You know, these things can be sometimes produced in another country or sold to a third country, which then sells it through another intermediary into Russia, and then it makes its way to the Russian Ministry of Defense and defense production there. You know, there's another thing, the so-called Belarus gap. There's a list of thousands of goods that are sanctioned and cannot go to Russia, but there's only about 500 goods that are sanctioned and can't go to Belarus. And Belarus is effectively under the control of Russia and effectively a party to this conflict. And so if these components can just be sold to Belarus, well, then they're effectively sold to Russia. There are also issues with, you know, companies that are in the EU but aren't EU companies and aren't subject to some of these same sanctions, and they are also selling goods to Russia and to Belarus. I mean, there are a number of problems with our enforcement of these sanctions. The sanctions regime has been historic, but we also need to invest in enforcement of these sanctions. We have to close these loopholes. In the U.S., that means funding and staffing the authorities that would be responsible for enforcing these sanctions. They are facing a pretty historic task right now, and they don't really have the resources for it.
Turning over to the Ukrainian side now, Zelensky recently dismissed his general, Zaluzhny. What are your thoughts on his reasoning behind that? Although, of course, I don't really know exactly what he was thinking, but what's your best theory and what do you think of the replacement and the potential new direction or military strategy that might come under the new leadership?
Yeah. So I think there's a couple things that are good to kind of set the stage on this. One is that we can remember Ukraine is a democratic country. And the ultimate responsibility for the prosecution of this war rests with President Zelensky. And it's at his discretion who are the military leaders that are in charge. During the Civil War in the United States, Lincoln famously cycled through general after general after general until he finally came to Ulysses S. Grant, who was able to win the war for the Union. Just changing your military leadership in and of itself is not something that is scandalous or cause for deep concern. And already we're hearing that Zaluzhny's replacement, Oleksandr Sirsky, is performing quite well. He's, his team, the generals that he is bringing in are quite competent. And Sirsky himself is quite competent. And so there is reason to be hopeful that, perhaps this could be a meaningful refresh of Ukraine's military leadership as Ukraine itself tries to refresh and restart and reconstitute and prepare for what comes next. In terms of the reasoning of why this happened, there's a couple things that have floated around and theories. One of them was that after Ukraine's counteroffensive last year, that there was disagreement between Zelensky and Zaluzhny about that, and that Zaluzhny had not succeeded in the counteroffensive, and that this was grounds for a change. Another theory that has gone is that Zelensky was starting to see Zaluzhny as something of a political rival. Zaluzhny, according to public polling, has greater public trust from Ukrainians than Zelensky himself. And that Zelensky, at the end of the day, is a politician who doesn't want a political threat like that. And so he dismissed Zaluzhny and took him out of that. Now, one thing that I had a question about that theory from a congressional staffer a couple months ago, saying, shouldn't that be a really concerning thing? And if that theory is correct, and that's why in whole or in part Zaluzhny was dismissed, I think that one thing that we can say about that is there's a good comparison to be made between the U.S. and Ukraine here. In the U.S., during the beginning of the full-scale invasion, we largely set aside our domestic politics for this greater goal to help Ukraine. Ukraine did the same thing. Ukraine has a lively domestic political scene, and they set aside those politics to come together for the war. 2 years in the U.S., we are seeing the return of politics in Washington, and 2 years in Kyiv, we are starting to see the return of politics in Ukraine as well. It is difficult to maintain unity above all else in a democratic society where there is disagreement, where there is accountability to voters. And this is part of democracy. So all of these are some different theories and some different explanations about what happened. But I think that, again, what we can come back to and remember is Ukraine is a democracy, and Zelensky has the authority to do this, and responsibility for the war lies with him.
Zooming way out again, a very simple question here, but for people who may not have been following the war all that closely or who have been, but just not carefully enough, let's say Ukraine and Russia are these two chess players, and how would you describe their relative styles of play in this war? How have they each approached the battlefield?
So Russia, by and large, has continued to fight the way that, say, the Soviet Union fought. Massive artillery advantage, bombing cities, bombing positions, annihilating what is up there, and then sending waves of humans to try to overwhelm your enemy. We've seen this quite a couple times on the battlefield, in particular in places like Bakhmut and Avdiivka, where these human waves of Russian soldiers were going forward and getting mowed down by the Ukrainians, where the Russians are acting almost as if they have an infinite amount of soldiers to run through, that they can't run out of manpower, and that's kind of the way they're fighting. That we're also seeing that in the amount of and quality of training for Russian soldiers. You know, when they staged their big mobilization campaign, they were sending very poorly trained and very poorly equipped soldiers to go fight and then die in Ukraine. But through this sheer force and numbers, they try to overwhelm Ukrainian fighters. Now, Ukraine has had kind of, I mean, I'm not an expert on this one, and so I don't want to pretend to be. But from my perspective, I would say that they have tried to take almost a hybrid style of warfare here. Ukraine's military in 2014, when Russia first invaded, was, you know, quite similar to this old Soviet style military. And it was poorly funded, poorly equipped, poorly trained. And that allowed Russia to make some real gains and to take Crimea and to take a good chunk of the Donbas. Ukraine then spent 8 years trying to professionalize its military, to NATOize its military, to fight more like a Western force, training with Western forces, and trying to adopt some of these Western doctrines. And we saw this kind of difference of quality of soldiers versus quantity of soldiers, particularly in the first, you know, maybe year and a half of the war. And Ukraine being provided with some of the top of the line Western weapons was able to use these weapons quite well to have to try to cut this advantage with Russia. They may not have as many soldiers, but they can have a higher quality of soldier and they can have better weapons. They're able to mow through these lines of Russian forces. They're also leading the way really in drone warfare and unmanned systems. Ukraine is the first country in the world to have a ministry or a branch of its armed forces dedicated solely to unmanned systems. We saw just how important aerial drones were in the beginning of the war. They continue to be important and to help fill the gap in some ways with this artillery ammunition shortage. And we're also seeing just how important unmanned surface vehicles, naval drones, are in this battle for the Black Sea. Most of these Russian warships have been destroyed thanks to these naval drones. So Ukraine is really opening up, I would say, a new domain, a new way of fighting war, thanks to unmanned vehicles. Now, Russia is also learning these same lessons, and they are investing heavily in drones as well. And they're getting help from China and Iran, particularly on this. And Russia is building lots of these Iranian Shahid drones. They're now producing them domestically. And they are trying to learn some of these same lessons that Ukraine has learned when it comes to that.
On the Russian strategy there, behaving as if they have an infinite number of soldiers. So when does that strategy start to run out for them? When they don't have an infinite number of soldiers. What's the situation look like right now? Are they scrambling to bring in more and get them from other countries? Like, how is this working? Or are they having a crisis, or is a crisis looming?
So there is not a crisis looming on the horizon for them. But at the same time, Putin is very wary of another mass mobilization campaign in Russia. The first time that they tried to do that in late 2022, it was very unpopular politically. And we did see open protests, particularly in the places where mobilization hit the hardest, you know, the ethnic republics, and especially in the North Caucasus, where young men were being drafted into the military at a higher rate than, say, young men in Moscow or St. Petersburg. And that, unfairness, that disproportionality was felt. And Putin has been very wary of another big mobilization like this because there are real domestic political risks. Now, as it stands right now, they don't need to do another one in the near future, at least. Mm-hmm. But that situation could change. Russia right now wants to get back on the offensive. You know, again, Zelensky said that we can expect a new Russian offensive later this year or in the summer. And Russia will want to try to push as far as it can to break through Ukrainian lines. and occupy more territory. That means stretching out. That means supplying the forces that are going forward. And this was something they really struggled with in the early days of the invasion. One of the reasons why the Battle of Kyiv was won was because Russian forces were so overextended and couldn't be supplied and didn't have the logistics to maintain going forward like that. Now, have they learned that lesson? We'll see.
This has been an enlightening conversation. Thank you. Final question. I'm an American and I live out in the Midwest, let's say, and I just don't see why we're spending all this money to help another country over there in Europe. I don't get it. It's not helping America. We should be putting that money here in America. Talk to me about why I might be wrong and why it matters to help Ukraine, not just for Ukraine's sake, not just for the, I suppose, the moral argument of this is an unlawful and genocidal invasion, but maybe the ramifications that a Russian victory would have for Europe and even beyond Europe. And try to persuade me on this point if you can.
Yeah, I'm glad that you asked that. I think that's a great place to end this conversation. This war matters to us as Americans. It impacts us as Americans, even if we don't see it or don't recognize it. It isn't just morally right. It isn't just the right thing to do to help a free people stand up and defend themselves against genocide. But it's in America's security interests. It's in our economic interests. And it's in our strategic interests. It's in our security interests because, as we talked about before, Russia doesn't want to stop at Ukraine. Russia wants to go further. And in Putin's mind, he has seen that the West can be afraid of Russia, can be deterred by his nuclear threats. And so, especially if somebody like Donald Trump comes into power, who has said that he would not stand with NATO allies that got attacked by Russia, in Putin's mind, he can win in Ukraine, and then he can attack Poland or the Baltics, and he can go further. He can keep widening this war. Now, that would mean, first, that a NATO ally has been attacked, and America is obligated to defend that ally. We are obligated to send soldiers to help fight. Now, it is far more preferable to give Ukrainians the tools they need to stop Russia now than to have to send Americans to fight tomorrow. Now, even if, you know, America were to not respect Article 5 and not aid our allies, I think we've seen in the past what happens when a wider war of aggression and conquest in Europe keeps on going. America was not able to sit it out last time. We got pulled in before. And so it's far better to stop that ahead, to end this now and to stop Putin now and keep them from going further. So that's the security interest. The economic interest is, look, when we help Ukraine, again, it's not just the right thing to do, but it's not charity. It also helps us. We've talked about today how America's defense industrial base has been underinvested in and has atrophied in many ways. Now, let's say that this supplemental aid package for Ukraine passes Congress. About two-thirds of that $61 billion is spent right here in the United States. That's tens of billions of dollars that are being invested in producing the weapons to keep us safe. It's invested in jobs. It's invested in reopening factories. It's money that spreads out across the country and that invests in our communities. So that's a selfish thing to say. It's not just the right thing to do, but it helps us. It's in our interest there. And then in the strategic interest, we have the biggest war in Europe since World War II. And the whole world is watching what happens. If Russia wins, that is a signal to dictators around the world that you should do a couple things. You should build nukes to scare the United States away from helping anybody that gets invaded. And you should invade your neighbors and take their land and resources and people and conquer them for yourselves. Because you can, because we've shown that Russia was able to do it. And that makes the world a much less safe place. More conflict. Trade gets disrupted. You know, that means higher prices, higher energy prices. Our goods may not get to us on time or may not come at all. You know, the whole world as we know it could be disrupted if we return to this era that we thought we had moved beyond, where countries are building up their armies to invade their neighbors and take what they want. That's a very different world that none of us are familiar with. And it's one that I personally would not like to get familiar with.
I hope that the future is bright for the people of Ukraine.
I do too. I mean, this is the most difficult period I think that we've had yet. And, you know, for the organization that I work for, ROSM for Ukraine, you know, humanitarian aid and advocacy organization. And they've been doing, I joined them last summer, and they've been doing advocacy in Washington for continued aid to Ukraine for all the reasons I just outlined. And up to this current fight on supplemental aid, you know, there were a lot of wins, and the you know, political wins were in Ukraine's favor. And it was a lot easier to fight this fight. And this is the first time in the U.S., I think, that up to now, since the full-scale invasion, that this is getting really difficult. And it's happening for a lot of reasons, but it's tough right now. I'm still optimistic that the supplemental aid is going to pass, but this job is getting a whole lot harder.
Unrelated to this, but when you were talking about Russia eviscerating the news, have you heard of Samizdat Online?
Yeah.
They're an interesting group. They try to bypass DNS blockades to make it so that people in Russia can actually read the news, and you can get the news to people in these ways. I find it, especially as a journalist, of course, I find that powerful.
Yeah, I mean, it's brilliant and inspiring to see people who are trying to solve these problems and help in that way. And that's wonderful to see. I mean, it's the name, Samizdat. I mean, it's literally happening because it's like what we saw under the Soviet Union. Because this level of repression is so much greater. I mean, it's like Back to the Future in all of the worst ways.
It is. The repression is greater, but the liberal dissidents are getting smarter. All right, take care.
You too. Bye.